Welcome to the Court of Appeals. As you probably both know, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument. And the podium does move up and down, so feel free to adjust that. When you begin, please introduce yourself and the name of your client so that we can ensure we have correct pronunciations for everyone's names. In addition, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So if you would like to get started, feel free to begin when you are ready.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher Mishek. I represent Aaron Gant. Mr. Gant was convicted of first-degree drug sale and possession of ammunition. This case should be reversed and remanded to the district court for a new sentencing hearing where Mr. Gant can have the assistance of counsel to argue at sentencing. And really for two main reasons. First, he didn't validly waive counsel prior to sentencing. And second, the court erred in considering a federal conviction and custody status point related to that because the state failed to produce sufficient evidence. I want to first get into the first reason. Gant's waiver of counsel here was invalid. He didn't really fully understand the stakes, and he didn't go into sentencing with his eyes wide open. The court really erred here in each step of the process. At first, there was really no clear and unequivocal request to proceed pro se. There was a clear request to discharge his attorney, but that's a different question. He never said, "Your Honor, I want to go pro se. I understand that if my attorney is being discharged, that I'm going to go ahead and I'm stuck with that decision." That was never really discussed. And so I think the first step of the analysis is there a clear and unequivocal request to go pro se? And there wasn't. The second kind of step in the process is outlined in State v. Page. And in Page.
Counsel, before we get there.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with you that there's no Rule 5 waiver here. Our case law does suggest that there are you can infer a waiver based on circumstances. One of the circumstances that the state highlights is your client's experience with the criminal justice system. This isn't his first time in court. I think he had 7 points. I think one of the pre-plea worksheets said 7 points. One said 9 points. I'm not sure. In any event, he's very well-versed in what's going on, and there were a lot of delays. How should we consider that? Those facts together in the analysis of whether
right.
he understood what he was doing and
yeah.
understood what the consequences were of discharging his counsel.
I agree that the case law allows you to examine all the circumstances of what was happening. It was certainly, part of it is criminal record. Has he been in court? And obviously he has. I'm not disputing that. I think what I'd point the court to is really his statement right after sentencing began. He, right away said, "I would like to," here's the quote. He said, "I'm just trying to see if I could reserve the right to hire new counsel." So he said that like immediately as the court turned to him to request, arguments about his plea withdrawal. So I don't think, I think the record there just shows he didn't fully get it, that he was kind of walking into this without an attorney, because right away he asked for one. I also think that this case, there was some nuance to the sentencing argument that I don't think even an experienced defendant would understand. There was an agreement from the state of a downward durational departure based on the offense being less serious and less onerous. And even though he didn't show up to sentencing, and the plea bargain was totally gone at that point, he still had an argument at sentencing that his crime was still less onerous. That still existed. And I don't think that point is sort of nuanced, and I think requires an attorney to understand that you can still go forward and argue that. He could have, made a motion, a downward departure motion. At that point, the plea was just open. So I think there, even though he's experienced, I think that the issue was, somewhat subtle, and and required counsel to move forward with. And I don't think you can fully infer from just his experience that he understood fully that he was going to be expected, to make certain arguments at sentencing. And I think at that point he was sort of focused on the plea withdrawal.
Although the district court did state, did it not, that with withdrawal of counsel, they were still going to go forward with sentencing. I mean, I think that was stated multiple times.
So the way I read the transcript on that was the judge telling him that it was the state's desire to move forward and that I haven't ruled on that yet. That's the way I read it, that he wasn't told we're going forward. It was, Mr. Gant, the state's going to request here that we go forward. I haven't ruled on that yet. And the court said, we can talk about that later, but let's go to discharge first. That's the wrong order. The court needed to talk about whether we're going to go forward today. And if the court decided, there's been too much delay here, we're going to have sentencing Mr. Gant. Then he would have known for sure, I'm walking into this, firing my attorney today, I know I'm walking into this without an attorney. And I think that's the distinction here. And if you compare this to the other cases that I cited, Worthy and Brody, I think Camacho as well, in each of those cases, the defendant fully understood and we're told, if you fire your attorney right now, we're going forward, and you're gonna be stuck with it. I think the defendant in Camacho even said, oh yeah, I guess I'm gonna be stuck with it. So even though in those cases, there wasn't a formal waiver, you can read that record and say, okay, this defendant got it. He was going forward to sentencing or trial, and he understood fully what was going on here with firing his attorney. Well, I think the distinction here, just to finish up with your question, is that he wasn't clearly told, we're going forward now with sentencing.
Can I just ask another? My read of the transcript isn't just that he wasn't given a Rule 5 waiver in writing, that he wasn't advised, but also that he seems to have made a request for substitute counsel, and the district court never ruled on that. Is that just an independent basis for reversal here because the district court abuses discretion by not considering his request?
Yeah, yes, I think it is under Page because there was a request 2 days before sentencing where it was granted it was in front of a different judge, I think, covering the calendar. But there was a request then, and then there was a request immediately after the discharge. And I think that is a grounds for reversal under Page because Page basically commands the courts or instructs them to determine if it's appropriate for the defendant to proceed as requested. So that language right there, the court needed to think about it and say, okay, well, he's asked for counsel, so let's talk about whether that's appropriate. Are you asking for a continuance to move forward? If he says yes, well, then the court can rule on the continuance. And if the court finds it's inappropriate to continue, a week or two for him to find a new private counsel, then we'd have that in the record. But there wasn't a ruling on that. There just wasn't any findings. So I do think that is just a grounds in itself to reverse.
I'm concerned about reversal here and what happens next because I don't think there's going to be a plea offer, and I think that he's at the risk of federal prosecution, and I'm wondering if this is what you really want to do here.
Judge, we're not asking for plea withdrawal anymore. It was just a footnote dropped in my appellant's brief. But right now we're asking for a resentencing hearing where he can have the assistance of new counsel to argue his sentencing motion, either submit a downward departure motion or argue, he should get the low end of the box. He got mid-range. And again, the state agreed at sentencing during the plea negotiations, the state agreed that it was a crime less onerous, or that was the grounds at least for a departure. So I think, his ask here isn't that much. I mean, he's asking for another shot at a sentencing argument with an attorney who can make an either an appropriate downward departure motion present mitigating circumstances about why he should end up lower in the box.
And to the extent if a rehearing were to occur, your position is that the state would be permitted to bring in additional evidence of the other convictions, the out-of-state?
Exactly. Election. Yeah, I think the case law is clear in that I don't, if you agree with me on the federal crime issue, that I don't win straight out, that it's really a remand situation and that the state is allowed to bring in evidence at that point. And you know, just to pivot to that issue, I don't think the evidence is sufficient here to give him 2.5 points. I mean, 2.5 points is a lot under the guidelines. And so it's not only just the conviction, it's also the custody status point related to it. And the state had to prove by a fair preponderance that there is a federal conviction and that he was also on a custody status while he committed the crime. There are indications in the record that that such a conviction might exist. I'm not going to sit here and say that that's not true, but I also think that there is a standard under Malley, and the standard really wasn't met here. There was no certified record, and then there was no testimony from the probation agent. If they can't find a certified record, which would be kind of shocking with a federal offense, the other remedies or the other procedure is to have the probation agent testify about what they did, who they called, why this copy or whatever is sufficient, and none of that was done here. So I think on that grounds we are requesting reversal as well on that. And that could be relitigated on a remand. I think I've covered a lot of what I wanted to say. You know, Rule 5.05, as Judge Frisch mentioned, wasn't followed. There wasn't a written waiver. It wasn't made orally on the record. And really, he wasn't advised about the kind of what he needed to be advised about in that list of things in 5.05. The fact that there were mitigating circumstances that existed, there are other facts really essential to his broad understanding of kind of the consequences that he would be, you know, required as to argue things just like an attorney. And it's clear that he wasn't ready for any of that. He was not even on the same, you know, argument plane as the prosecutor, who was appropriately arguing under the fair and just standard with the plea withdrawal motion and then arguing sentencing duration. And Mr. Gant kept focusing on why he didn't come to sentencing before, but the judge had kind of already considered that and ruled that the plea bargain was destroyed by him not coming up and that it was an open plea. So I do think that under all the circumstances, there was error here that needs to be corrected. Mr. Gant is asking, for a remand for an attorney to argue his sentencing point. If there aren't any questions, I think I'm going to cede the rest of my time. The one thing I wanted to correct is on the end of my reply brief, I refer to Mr. Gant as Griffin. I was just wanted to correct that. Griffin was the case.
Thank you, counsel. All right, and we'll turn to respondents. Counsel, next.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. Appellant does not appeal his convictions for first-degree drug possession of cocaine with intent to sell, or his conviction for ineligible possession of ammunition. Instead, appellant presents two issues regarding his sentence, and appellant is not entitled to relief on either issue. I have a few points that I'd like to make, but first I'll outline a few important parts of respondent's brief for this court to consider. First, on the issue of waiver of counsel, appellant did validly waive his right to counsel at sentencing.
Where in the record is that?
Your Honor, the entire sentencing transcript is quite long, and when this court determines what constitutes a waiver within that lengthy transcript, this court is examining the particular facts and circumstances surrounding the entire case and the hearing and the defendant. It's a holistic approach. So
Rule 5 sets forth what constitutes a waiver of counsel.
Correct.
Best practice is a written waiver.
Absolutely.
And we don't have that, right?
Correct.
Okay. So then we look at a number of factors to determine whether the circumstances would support a waiver of counsel.
Yes.
And what circumstances can you point to in the transcript which would indicate that Mr. Gant waived counsel within the meaning of Rule 5, that he understood all of the things that are set forth in Rule 5 such that a waiver was achieved?
Yes. And first, I agree with Your Honor that you do look at the facts and circumstances of the case to determine if an implicit waiver in accordance with Rule 5 had occurred there. So I agree with Your Honor that the written waiver did not occur. But if you look at the text of the rule, Rule 504 advises a number of different topics that a district court and a defendant should discuss. Not all of those, A through E, were even applicable at the sentencing phase there. So at sentencing, when appellant unequivocally discharged his private counsel, some of these topics, A through F, weren't even applicable. The nature of the charges, we are beyond that. We are at sentencing now. All offenses included within the charges were beyond that. He's pled to two. Presumptive commit, we are at sentencing here. D, there may be defenses. We are beyond that. It's at
sentencing
here.
Skipped over one. Range of allowable punishments.
Yep. So C,
we're not beyond that.
C and E, we are not beyond that. Range of allowable punishments. This sentencing occurred almost a year after the plea went through. The plea went through with a negotiated downward durational departure. That was highly favorable to defendant in this case.
His plea was not accepted.
Correct.
His plea was not accepted until sentencing. And so we have a whole bunch of stuff that's going on at sentencing, mm-hmm. and it's not clear to me in the record that the district court, in proceeding without counsel, without advised Mr. Gant of, you realize when you proceed without counsel, you're going to be representing yourself at the sentencing hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the range of possible consequences that can occur if you represent yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that in the record?
Your Honor, I didn't see the text of that in the transcript, but fortunately, appellant was represented by counsel during plea negotiations. Through his counsel, he negotiated the sentence. He knew what the presumptive commits were for each sentence.
How can we assume that to be true when there are a number of hearings that happened between the plea hearing and sentencing where Mr. Gant said himself and counsel said, we're not communicating. I try to talk to him. He won't talk to me. I'm not able to communicate with him. Doesn't that indicate to the district court that there's some breakdown in communication between counsel and the defendant such that the district court can't assume that the defendant's been fully advised of the possible consequences?
Your Honor, truthfully, I am not recalling places in the transcript where appellant is appearing between plea and sentence arguing that he doesn't like his counsel because of a lack of communication. I don't recall that in the record at all.
I think there was a Zoom hearing, and then there was a hearing when he didn't appear, and counsel said that on the record. I think it's in there a few times.
What I recall is that appellant called over the weekend his attorney's office, and that was while in custody after he was apprehended in Florida. So the first time he absconded away from sentencing, he called his attorney over the weekend to say, I want more time. Even though I absconded to Florida, I want more time to take care of my business before I'm incarcerated. That, I do recall that. But what appellant did say at his hearings is that my counsel isn't requesting the continuances I'm asking for. And the presumption there is, of course, they're communicating. And defense counsel is saying, I'm not going to continue to ask for continuances because there's no basis there. So I don't recall more than one instance where there was like a voicemail left for counsel, but I can certainly review the transcripts.
If that is in the record, would you agree that that's some indicate, if there is some indication in the record that there's a breakdown in communication between counsel and the defendant, that that would be a red flag that perhaps the defendant needs to be more thoroughly advised of the potential consequences?
I guess I don't see to what end. If the end is still he wants to discharge counsel, I mean, he has the right to self-representation there. So
the end is that he wants a downward dispositional or durational departure, and he's not communicating with counsel.
Oh, I see what you're saying. And if he's not communicating with his counsel for the purpose of a downward durational departure, he had already gotten that through his counsel. So I know there was communication there because that was effectively done in this case.
Let me ask this a different way.
Okay.
What, in your view, what is the best practice for a district court after a defendant says, I want to discharge my counsel?
Mm-hmm.
What is a district court supposed to do?
A district court, the best practice is to follow Page. However, under this case, under these facts and circumstances, which this court is conscribed to examine each individual case, in this case, we are post-plea, post any trial phase, we are at sentencing here. And this particular defendant got a very favorable agreement, and his jobs were twofold. Don't commit new offenses, show up for sentencing. You got released pending sentencing to take care of your business, and here we are, it's time to become incarcerated. So what happened in this case was the length of time is just so expansive between him signing the plea petition and the plea hearing. The plea hearing, 2 months later, initial sentencing. COVID for several months, January. Failure to appear in January. Absconding, then we have a warrant. Comes back in April. And the April gets released, absconds again, gets picked up again in June. The only reason this defendant was ever sentenced was because he was in custody here. He showed up at sentencing well aware that he had almost an entire year to take care of his business. And at sentencing, even if he wanted to discharge his counsel, the arguments are still the same, and the same arguments were presented to the district court, both at plea and at sentencing.
Are you saying that the best practice of a district court when a defendant requests to discharge their counsel is the same, or it's somehow different because of these intervening circumstances? I mean, the rule says what a district court is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the best practice?
It is the best practice.
And I mean, you know, one of the other problems I had, and I mentioned this to your esteemed colleague, and that is he did make a request to substitute counsel. Mm-hmm. I want new counsel. And I just don't see the district court even considering that request anywhere in the record.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that not a fatal problem in this case?
I have two responses. I hope I remember both in order. My first response is along the lines of a best practice conversation. I agree with Your Honor that then Judge Hudson's opinion in Page lists the best practice, yes. However, best practice, boots on the ground in a district court, as I'm sure this panel is well aware, is not always what occurs. District courts are chaotic. This court is already aware the plea was chaotic. Sentencing was chaotic. Every Zoom hearing in the interim, chaotic. So although there is a best practice as laid out in Page, that doesn't always necessarily occur. And rightfully so, other cases say best practice, even if it's not followed perfectly to a T, all T's crossed, I's dotted. If the totality of the circumstances, for lack of a better word, the holistic approach to reviewing the case circumstances, the defendant and his experience, if all of that shows a valid waiver occurred, nothing should happen at an error-correcting court regarding that waiver. So that's the first point. Case law is very clear. You can't hold a district court to the best practice if other circumstances would have led to the same result, which is the case here. And, Your Honor, could you remind me your second, the question that you ended with so I can remember?
Why is it not fatal to this case because he asked for substitute counsel and
yes,
it was never considered by the district court? Why isn't that just an abuse of discretion to fail to rule on the motion?
Yes. And I agree with Your Honor that, you know, it didn't, the analysis here blended. That is true. But the analysis still occurred. For the district court to entertain a substitution of counsel request, it necessarily would have had to address a continuance request. And there was no way this district court was going to continue sentencing for one more moment.
Then why is it that the district court said to him, when he, when Mr. Gant, when he said, I want to discharge my counsel, we're going to put a pin in the question of whether we're going to proceed with sentencing? Why didn't the district court just say, we're going to proceed with sentencing. If you choose to discharge your counsel, you're on your own without counsel. It did it in the reverse order. So didn't that leave Mr. Gant with an impression that we were going to talk about, as the district court said, sentencing after the discharge motion?
My recollection of the transcript is on roughly between pages 7 and 9, the district court is attempting to explain to appellant what is exactly has happened over pages 1 through 7, and then what will continue to happen. And I don't disagree that the district court said the state intends to proceed with sentencing, but the district court also stated that we will proceed with sentencing. So the district court stated it two different ways, but no doubt sentencing was going to occur that day. And as this court's well aware, the transcripts from the intervening hearings between plea and sentencing shows that even appellant's counsel, then appointed private counsel, explained to defendant that he has to show up at sentencing. You have to be here.
Is that a problem, though, if the district court, and I don't recall the district court saying we will proceed with sentencing. I'll assume for the moment that that's exactly what the district court said. Is it a problem for the district court to say we will proceed with sentencing while the defendant's motion for substitution of counsel is pending and has not been considered? Is that prejudging that motion without hearing from the parties? Is that another problem with this sort of quagmire that we have?
I apologize. Could you repeat that?
Maybe.
Okay.
If my recollection serves. Let's assume that the district court said we will proceed with sentencing.
Okay. And, Your Honor, my apologies. My distinct recollection of the phrase is the state will proceed with sentencing. That's the phrase okay. I'm recalling. But moving
all
on.
Right. So, all right. So if the district court has already decided we're going to go forward with sentencing no matter what, isn't that running roughshod, essentially, over the defendant's request for substitution of counsel pending sentencing? So it's decided that motion without hearing from the parties about that request? I mean, I don't think it ever heard from the parties about that request other than Mr. Gant's request.
I believe I understand Your Honor's question. And what that question indicates is, for lack of a better phrase, the district court is damned if it did, damned if it didn't type of thing?
I think it's more of it's predisposed to rule on a motion before hearing from the parties.
Right. But if appellant's argument is that the district court should have said, here's what will happen if I discharge counsel, do you want to do that? And if the district court did what Your Honor has said in the hypo is, we're going to continue on, do you still want to? That's exactly what appellant is saying the district court should have done here. So it was either error if they did or error if they didn't. But again, under the facts and circumstances of this case, there is no concern of this court under the standard of clear error. Is there a definite and firm conviction that a mistake of law or fact had been made at sentencing, requiring reversal? Absolutely not. And again, the rule is the particular facts and circumstances of this case, this defendant, these charges, and the circumstances that indicate this appellant clearly made with eyes wide open. He didn't want his counsel. He did not feel his counsel was expressing his wishes to the district court effectively, specifically regarding continuances. There's also some vague comment about didn't disclose things to me or didn't talk about rights. But again, we are past the plea. The plea was knowing, intelligent, voluntary. And no one is arguing otherwise on appeal now. The other interesting thing is appellant today, I realize I'm out of time. I have two brief comments if presiding judge will allow me. The first is today appellant's counsel indicated that there was sentencing argument nuances to be made at sentencing. And to be clear, any sentencing argument for a a lesser sentence is not appropriate here, I mean, to remand to redo that, because one, the district court had already heard what a sentencing argument would look like. The downward durational departure was part of the plea. Everybody agreed that, yeah, he could. And even if remand did occur, the district court is not required to depart, even if there is the presence of one or more mitigating circumstances. So in that regard, the district court already heard the arguments and wasn't required to follow them under the plea agreement or under the law. There's no nuance there. And the transcripts show that the defendant in this case did make those same arguments. He said, I am sorry I didn't abide by the two things I was supposed to do to get my plea agreement honored. And so he was very articulate why the district court should still sentence him the same way, even if he didn't use the words, I need, you know, the 80-some months that was agreed to before. The second thing, and very briefly, I appreciate, Your Honor. The posture of relief requested in this case is unique. And at first blush, it seems reasonable, just remand so that he can have counsel and just make the argument. But what happened here in this case is that appellant got a guideline sentence. I can think of no case where this court has reversed a guideline sentence so that appellant could make an argument for another guideline sentence. So that is unique here. I don't think there's authority for that. That was my final point. And if there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer.
If there were a remand, Ms. Carnelli, is it your position that the district court would have the discretion to make whatever sentence, impose whatever sentence they chose to?
That wouldn't exceed the 128. I don't have a reason to dispute that, that it shouldn't go above 128 if the plea were intact. But I didn't look into the plea issue because that wasn't raised, so my apologies.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll turn back to counsel for appellant for 5 minutes and rebuttal.
Thanks. Just a couple quick points. I disagree that, you know, there was no way the court was going to, grant a continuance and that it was for sure happening. I mean, the court told Mr. Gant, in the transcript says, the court turned to Mr. Gant and said, you know, the state's requesting that sentencing happen today. And the court said, then I see from what you're telling me that you have some issues with that, and we'll address that in a little bit. So the court was leaving it open at that point. There wasn't a ruling. I don't think it's fair to say there's no way the court would have granted a continuance. And again, Mr. Gant would be asking for a short continuance to hire private counsel. This isn't a situation where we're continuing with the plea withdrawal motion where, you know, it would be a long process and a trial would happen. Mr. Gant was in custody as well. So if the court said, you know what, okay, we'll give you a couple weeks, I think that's a potential here. So I disagree with that concept. The communication with the attorney, there was a communication breakdown and they weren't talking at all. And the attorney did make talk on the record about that. And he said that I try to show up at the jail to talk to him and he wouldn't talk to me. So I don't think this is a case where you can just presume that the attorney went over everything with Mr. Gant about waiver and whether it was a good idea to waive counsel. Those cases where that's presumed, I think there's a case, Jones from the 70s, that's discussed where that presumption happens. The attorney in Jones actually, you know, was instructed to talk to the defendant about the waiver, and the court didn't know the details about the discussion, but you know there was evidence in the record that there was an actual discussion about waiver and kind of what that would entail. And so the court said in that situation, we can presume that the attorney told the client that, you know, it was a bad idea or here's what's going to happen.
Mr. Mishek, what in your view is the best practice in the absence of a written waiver under Rule 5 for a district court to follow when presented with the kind of requests, sort of jumbled requests that Mr. Gant made at the time of the discharge?
Well, I think the best practice is to go through the rule, go through Rule 5.05. And just to go through the factors. It doesn't have to be written. If everything's on the record and he's, you know, the defendant's recognizing everything and tracking, I think that's best practice. And then to go with Page. I think Page sets it out pretty clearly. You know, ascertain how the defendant wishes to proceed after counsel's discharge. You know, a quick question would be, after I discharge your counsel, you know, how do you want to, do you want a continuance to get a new attorney, or do you want to go pro se? Those are your two options. Well, Mr. Gant made it clear eventually that he wanted a new attorney, and then it just was sort of in the air and not ruled on. And then, you know, best practices is to make a ruling on the on what's appropriate at that point. Deny the continuance request, or proceed, or grant it. So,
is there some reason if we do remand the case that it should not go back to the same district court
judge? You know, I haven't thought about that question. I
only ask because of the questions that I was asking at the end of Ms. Cornell's argument about perhaps some of these motions that were presented sort of in a summary way to the district court were prejudged.
I think it would be appropriate for the court to remand with instructions and say there should be a new judge just because of that. And I agree with that, and I wouldn't oppose that. But you know, honestly, I just haven't had the time to fully ponder it. But that's my initial impression.
I'm wondering what your response is to Ms. Cornell's argument at the very end of her period of time, where she said that she's unaware of any authority where we have remanded for reimposition of a guideline sentence.
Well, this case really isn't about the sentence. Like, that's not the issue we're appealing. We're not appealing we're appealing the decision or the decision we're appealing or the lack of decision is the waiver of counsel. So I don't think this is a case where you're actually reversing a sentence to then allow a judge to impose a sentence. I mean, I guess theoretically you are, but I just disagree with that concept in general. I think the issue here is about waiver of counsel. So if you reverse, you're reversing the process that happened during that waiver, and not necessarily the sentencing decision.
An attempt to provide some guidance to the district court?
Yes, yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys, and we appreciate the briefs you submitted and the argument today. It's been very helpful.
Thank you.
The case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.